Welcome to Pop the Left with C. Derek Varnon, normally Douglas Lane, but today we have on our panel Gene Bagelon, and we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories and the deep state. Now, those who've listened to Pop the Left for a long time know that conspiracy theories in the left come up a fair amount on our discussions, and we even have done at least one dedicated show to it in the original podcast series from 2012-2013. But we may have done another one in this run. I actually can't remember. So today, though, we're going to be talking about a very specific angle and with a very specific example, which is the history of the term the deep state and its relationship to Turkish politics, which is good Dr. Bagelon's specialty. And then the CIA conspiracy theories on the left and the kind of, and you and I have talked about this before on a Theorizing with a Hammer special, but the kind of omnipresence often, or an omnipotence often given to the CIA and the American deep state by the left, while also claiming its incompetence. And you and I kind of mutually fall more on that. A lot of times it's actually just incompetent. And so we're going to talk about that too. In the parent room today, we're going to be talking about the DSA's foreign policy delegations, particularly the ones to Peru and to Venezuela, as well as why you should stop caring about the TYT gray zone debates and maybe focus on something more important. But, you know, we'll get to that in the parent room. So those of you who are subscribers will have that to look forward to. Hey, Gene. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going? It's going well. How are you doing?
It's good. How does it feel to be Doug Lane? Or actually, in this case, you may be playing the role of me, and I'm playing the role of Doug Lane, which is even more confusing. But
so how does it feel to be Varn?
You are Schrodinger's Varn, Doug. You're Schrodinger's Varn or Doug Lane. You can pick which one you'd rather be, but you're one of us, so...
Well, I'm not going to answer that question. That's bait. That's just straight up bait. It's straight bait. I will be me. I will strike an independent path between Varnism and Lanism.
Yes, as Lanager Voss and Varn Yelts.
Well, you know, Varn's ultra leftism and Doug Lane's liberal idealism.
Oh yeah. Let's talk about the deep state. It's a word that gets thrown around all the time. I've noticed it's been mostly associated now with right-wing conspiracy theories and the Tucker Carlson crowd. Let me enunciate there. But it has a more interesting history, and I think we do need to understand that history in the context of Turkey to then understand maybe the rational core of truth to any deep state talk in the U.S. And I also want to talk about maybe a little bit about how it's being picked up by certain sectors of the left. I'm thinking of QAnon here, people around the gray zone, etc., in ways that maybe are not all that illuminating either. But we'll get to that. So where does the concept of deep state come from, Gene?
Well, I mean, in a kind of general sense, as a conception, the notion that there are kind of hidden brokers of power is nothing unique to the modern era. It's nothing unique to Turkey. You know, you can trace it back, you know, long before the modern era. So the notion that decisions get made behind the scenes are ancient. I think we can all recognize that as a part of political life. Conspiracy theories aren't something new. They are kind of an ever-present sort of tendency within politics. But this specific term, the deep state, as far as I understand, originates from Turkey, and it's within the context of studying Turkish politics and history that, you know, I came into contact, encountered this term, derin devlete, the deep state, within the Turkish political context. And more specifically, it referred to the kind of hidden relationships, or at least the kind of obfuscated relationships between various elements of the Turkish state, certain political factions, most notably on the far right in Turkey, mafia element, Kurdish tribal leaders, individuals associated with the special operations office in Turkey, the relationship between those groups and Project Gladio at the end, you know, which was a kind of intelligence stay behind operation established after the Second World War, during the Cold War. That's most well known within the Italian context, but there is also a kind of a branch in Turkey known as Contra Guerrilla, you know, the anti group. And so the kind of opaque political forces that operated behind the kind of formally democratic structures of the Turkish state sort of come to be known in Turkish political discourse as the deep state. But of course, you know, this concept long predates, you know, like the Cold War era. It's good. That intersects with kind of my the other theme you were talking about is the notion that, you know, on the left, that the CIA and the American intelligence services are kind of these omnipresent forces. You know, many of the figures associated with the deep state, you know, had training in the United States, worked with the United States intelligence. But the kind of existence of kind of opaque structures of power, relationships between criminal elements and elements of the military, that wasn't invented in the post Second World War era. You know, in a modern sense, you can see it all the way back to the to the Committee of Union and Progress, the so-called Young Turks, the opposition movement that developed during the late 19th century in opposition to Sultan Abdulhamid. Abdulhamid was kind of a neo-absolutist monarch who had crushed Sultan Abdulhamid was a neo-absolutist monarch who had crushed a brief experimentation in constitutional rule in the 1870s, and, you know, established himself as a dictator with a secret police, and very much was a kind of prototype of the kind of Middle Eastern dictator we know today. And the opposition movement that developed, you know, spread throughout various sectors of Ottoman sort of society, operating in the military, in the bureaucracy, amongst students, and, you know, meeting in Freemasons' lodges and places like that. So you had the emergence of these secret societies. Secret societies that actually existed before, but we have this sort of big sort of mushrooming of opposition groups and the Young Turks. And in 1908, there's a revolution in Turkey. The largest faction, the Committee of Progress and Union, which becomes the Committee of Union and Progress, comes to power. But rather than sort of transforming itself into an open democratic party, you still have all these opaque structures behind the scenes, you know, outside of the formal sort of structures of power. So, you know, we often think of, when we think of the Young Turks during the late Ottoman period, we think of the triumvirate, Talat Pasha, Enver Pasha, and Jamal Pasha. And, you know, these individuals had important roles in the government. Talat Pasha was Ministry of Interior. Jamal Pasha was a general in the army. Talat Pasha was the Minister of War. But they weren't, you know, the formal leaders of the government. But yet, you know, through the structures of the Committee of Union and Progress, through paramilitary organizations such as the Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa, the special organization, which sort of was a prototype of a kind of intelligence service / mafia organization, you know, this group wielded power and exercised and executed policy. And we see these sort of structures, we see kind of parallel structures of power in Turkey, throughout Turkish history. And of course, in the modern era, you know, this becomes heavily associated with the dirty war fought against the Kurdistan Workers' Party during the 1980s, unsolved mysteries, assassinations, intelligence operatives working with Islamist groups such as Hezbollah, Turkey, which is not the same as Hezbollah in Lebanon, you know, basically to wage war against the left-wing Kurdish nationalists. And of course, in a general sense, these you have these all these like connections and relationships between elements of the military and right-wing groups, the Grey Wolves, the Ulkucu, these kind of far-right fascist mobs, and you know how they're deployed in Turkish politics. So and you know, of course, this stuff was exposed in 1996, for example. There was a car crash, the Susurluk incident, where you know they found, you know, members of the military, right-wing Kurdish tribal leaders, you know, who are allied with the state, you know, members of the intelligence service, sort of together operating together in this kind of hidden way. So the deep state is a kind of concept that has was very common in Turkey to talk about, you know, the parallel structures of power that existed behind the facade of bourgeois democracy. Because, you know, one thing that's important to remember about Turkey is, you know, we often lump Turkey in with like third worldism. But what's interesting about Turkey is it kind of occupies a place not too dissimilar from Russia, in that it was in some ways, you know, part of the developing world, part of the old third world, but also in other ways was, you know, had sort of connections and political structures that were relatively inverted commas advanced. So, for example, Turkey had its first constitution before Russia did in the 1870s, before Japan did in the 1870s. You know, democracy, when people go, oh, Middle Easterners have no experience with democracy, it's like Middle Easterners were having elections in 1908. And, you know, they weren't like perfect elections, but they were elections with an electoral college. Well, you know, you have an electoral college here in the United States as well. So, you know, Middle Eastern people have been voting for over 100 years in elections. So you have in Turkey, which sort of inherited the institutional mantle of the Ottoman state, the continuation of both a kind of tradition of parliamentarianism, which was the face of the government. I would note here, the parliament of the Republic of Turkey, the Grand National Assembly of Turkey, is in a very literal sense a direct continuation. There's no rupture, but a continuation of the old Meclisi Mebusan, the Chamber of Deputies from the Ottoman era. So you have this like tradition of bourgeois democratic structures of power, existing, of course, in you know, under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of Turkey. It was a one-party state, but these institutions continue to exist. But at the same time, you have these informal networks of power that continue to undergird, you know, political life in Turkey. One of the striking points made, and this point was first really elaborated on by the historian Erik Jan Zurcher, was that the Committee of Union and Progress, the Young Turks, the political organization that orchestrated the overthrow of Sultan Abdülhamid, that dominated Ottoman politics from 1908 onwards, first indirectly and then progressively more directly, the architects of the Armenian genocide, this organization in a very literal infrastructural sense provided the basis for the Republican People's Party, the political organization of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and the political leadership of the Turkish state right down to the 1960s were all people whose political formation had taken place as members of the Young Turks. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why I do definitely think that the news network, the TYT, should probably change its name. It's very much the Washington Redskins of the independent media world, because this political organization, although beginning life as a kind of liberal constitutionalist organization, very quickly, especially after the Balkan Wars in 1912-1913, became a very sort of vicious Islamist slash ethno-nationalist political organization that engaged in extremely brutal ethnic engineering. The Armenian genocide, the annihilation of the Assyrian communities in eastern Anatolia was only one part of this. You know, there was also, you know, attempts to deport Muslim groups that were non-Turkish Muslim groups, to disperse them and, you know, build a Turkish Muslim sort of heartland.
And reclassifying Anatolian Christians who were effectively Turks as Greeks and sending them to Greece is also part of this as well. I've visited some of the villages, actually.
Exactly. So, I mean, some of the this kind of political power is nothing new in Turkey. You have kind of two tracks in Turkey. You have the state, which, you know, which is theoretically run by a president, a parliament, and so on and so forth. And then you have the deep state, which at various points in Turkish history, through the military, has intervened in politics. So, you know, you have the coup 1960, 1971, 1980, where elements of the bureaucracy and military has taken power. While at the same time, you have these elements of the state working actively to engineer Turkish political life. And after, obviously, during the Cold War, this included with involvement of the CIA through, you know, many of these like far right generals and colonels had training in the United States. But, you know, just kind of like pivot slightly towards the question of the CIA and the omnipotent octopus of American intelligence. These Turkish actors were very much operating within an indigenous tradition of sort of secret political activity, and be acting with their own interests, right? Which was to suppress communism, to suppress Kurdish nationalism, and other groups like that. And of course, across the Middle East, we see, you know, many of the revolutions from Egypt to Iraq and places like that were conducted and executed by secret cabals within, primarily within the military, whether the free officers in Egypt and Iraq. And these groups want the creation of American intelligence service. If anything, they owe their kind of intellectual origins a lot more to the kind of political activism that occurred during the late Ottoman period with these secret military organizations that sort of arose in opposition to Sultan Abdülhamid, rather than sort of some kind of like CIA infiltration plot within, you know, military organizations.
So what is the relationship of this establishment of the Turkish state as we currently know it to the U.S. Functionaries that kind of loosely get called the deep state right now?
Well, I will, you know, honestly speaking, I do not know how the term has kind of jumped, but, you know, I remember when I was at high school, when we were studying, you know, British politics, you know, one of the things our teacher talked about was the secret wiring of the British state, you know, these personal connections that people make in the judiciary at elite institutions like Oxford. You look at the British government now, they all study together, right? So how the word the deep state made a jump from Turkey specifically to the United States, I'm sure there's a very good Wikipedia article about this or something like that, but it's definitely, I think, come to be used in a similar way to the way it's used in Turkish discourse. And of course, within Turkish discourse, there are various kind of iterations of what the deep state is, from, you know, the kind of more mundane conception of it being these kind of like bureaucratic cabals that exist behind the scene but have effective political power, to the kind of more sensational conspiracy theories where, like, there's a secret, you know, a secret community of crypto Jews working for Israel, controlling things. And in the United States, I think there's certainly a utility in the more mundane sense to talk about a deep state. And I think Americans have been often very, at least, you know, liberals have been very reticent about even addressing the notion of a deep state. You know, they very much kind of buy into the, you know, supremacy of the president, the supremacy, you know, like Congress makes decisions, the state executes it. But, you know, I think more and more that, you know, people are coming to see kind of the you know, I think the cabal of power, bureaucratic inertia and control that, you know, restricts ex you know the executive power of elected officials. You know, they have to, you know, policy is personnel, and you know, a lot of this personnel remains in place. So of course, you know, the concept of a deep state makes sense in the United States, just as it makes sense in any sort of developed bureaucratic state, as you know. But I think, you know, we end up with kind of sensationalized versions of that. And I don't think this is anything new, Ron. I'm not an expert on the United States, but you know, the whole JFK conspiracy is all about like secret cabals within the American state, their connections with mafia groups working to assassinate an American president, right? So it's not a new conception, but I think definitely this word has taken on a life of its own, and it's kind of being integrated with all kinds of sensationalist notions, which have an element of truth. You know, we laugh at QAnon for the notion that Trump is leading this kind of secret war against a cabal of pedophiles that wear children's skin shoes. And people really believe that stuff. I had a friend in the UK. This is the beauty of social media. A friend in the UK who was really buying into this stuff. But there's a kernel of truth, right? I mean, we saw what was going on with Jeffrey Epstein, and we know the impunity with which the American elite can conduct itself. I mean, occasionally they go a little bit too far, like Jeffrey Epstein did, but the amount of stuff people get away with is insane. So I think this concept of deep state has gained a lot of purchase, and of course, it's gained a lot of purchase in the Trump years because of the fact that the deep state really has been at points trying to resist and assert power over the Trump administration, and these conflicts have been very public, you know, with all these secret op-eds and with Trump complaining about the deep state. So the concept, I think, has obviously been around for time immemorial, but I think at this current moment in American politics, the kind of the lid has exploded, you know, and I think it's exacerbated by the fact that many Americans feel that you know, elites can act with impunity, and when you have elites acting with impunity, that is fertile ground for the growth of conspiracy theories, which have some kind of basis in, you know, reality.
Do you think a lot of this has to do with the fact that like many ministries, a lot of the US apparatus is in the executive branch, and that it is unlike, say, the UK and a lot of parliamentary systems that has a shadow cabinet with a shadow executive? Because we don't have that, and because you don't have someone constantly working on policy in the background, that many of these positions are considered non-political when they clearly are, because they work at the behest of the president and are part of various security apparatuses that can be hardly said to be non-political. They may be nonpartisan, but they can't be said to be non-political. Do you think that has a lot to do? Because to me, that's the like the beginnings of the rational core, is that there is bureaucratic drift in the United States government. It does have clear
True.
self-interest. And there is a way in which Democrats in general have been really forgiving of continuity in government. There was some minor purges during the Obama administrations that most of us have forgotten, but they generally left a lot of the Bush security apparatus fairly alone. And you know, this is not just true for the security apparatus, it's also true for the medical apparatus. Like Fauci's been in his position forever, et cetera, and so forth. And so I think that leads to this perception that maybe the real government's in the executive, particularly when you have the executive seeming to war with itself in the case of Trump. But it's not been the only time that's happened. I mean, that happened under the Obama administration too, just nowhere near as loud and as consistent as it was with Trump.
Yeah, I certainly think the American bureaucratic structure in which you kind of purge the top. I mean, in Britain we have permanent secretaries, we have this career civil service. And of course, in Britain, you know, this was popularized in Britain. The concept that it's the bureaucracy that runs everything was popularized with the sitcom Yes Minister. Has anyone, have you seen, you know, I don't know if the viewers are familiar with Yes Minister, but it's basically,
I am.
It's the story of a minister who basically, the conceit of the show is every week he proposes a policy. Every week the bureaucrat who works for him finds a way to obstruct that policy and push it in the direction that the bureaucracy is. So, you know, in Britain, the notion of this kind of like omnipotent bureaucracy is sort of well established in British life. And of course, you know, it's often been the political right that has been the one that has been emphasizing the kind of inertia of this in terms of like the Thatcher revolution was in part a revolution against the kind of bureaucratic compromise that existed in the United Kingdom after the end of the Second World War. In the United States, obviously you have a different state of affairs where the top level of the bureaucracy is purged, you know, routinely as the executive changes. But I think what people are perhaps getting wise to is the fact that that purge is never actually really that deep. There's only a certain sort of pool of individuals from whom these bureaucratic elites are drawn. They are people who come from the same schools, who exist in the same social networks, and who have the same formation. So even though we have a rotation of individuals in a certain sense, even when you change the individual, it's basically the former guy's buddy from Harvard, so people are getting wise to this kind of bureaucratic inertia. And, you know, there are some advantages to having kind of expertise in certain elements of the government. You know, the Trump administration tried to put all kinds of kind of inexperienced political hacks into positions. They didn't make things better necessarily. They just, you know, having a bad structure and blowing up that bad structure, you know, it's more much the much, right? It doesn't make that much of a difference in terms of outcomes. It just ends up, you have one type of disaster versus another type of disaster. But yeah, I think people are getting wise to the existence of this bureaucratic establishment. I think it's like more easily exposed today. You know, I think people are like far less trusting media because now the linkages between political parties, the bureaucracy and stuff, and media are just so much more overt. And I think social media has part to do with this because it's just so much easier to find out this kind of information. Yes, there's a lot of trash on there. There's a lot of like overcomplicating things and conspiracy theories. But at the same time, it kind of undermines the legitimacy of the political order, which allowed the bureaucracy to maintain its kind of dominant position. It seems the only people who buy into it today are kind of MSNBC liberals who are now rallying behind professionality as a kind of as a virtue in and of itself, right?
Right. No, I mean, it's the same thing as when I would hear MSNBC liberals talk about how we should never abolish any administration, including ICE, because bureaucracy is good, and once it is established, we should just try to reform it. And I have literally heard that argument made. That's not me exaggerating. However, what I find interesting about this, though, is you compare the origins of the deep state and its use in Turkish politics and American politics. In American politics, you have something roughly like someone like Pareto would have described about the SPD, and what are, you know, in the Italian Socialist Party. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Pareto's theories ultimately, but there is a truth that like there is bureaucratic drift in both of the socialist parties. And in fact, I was shocked. I was listening to Ben Fine on an interview recently point out that like the SPD had more permanent full-time staffers than the current Labor Party. And this is the SPD of the 19-teens. Than the current Labour Party in Britain does, which is kind of shocking. So you do have people who are this political bureaucratic cadre, but in the case of the SPD, they're actually not directly involved with government. It's actually bureaucracy coming out of the party itself. One thing I find interesting about this is that while it does seem true that Trump had some kind of war going on in bureaucracy, also he seemed to wield power by not appointing people or by appointing people who did not have to be approved, by constantly having interim heads of things, which, you know, a lot of people have doubled down on as part of why things were a mess under during COVID. And while that may be the case, it's almost impossible to know because we don't have a a valid comparison for 100 years where we could say that if we had working ministries in all these areas, they would have been a whole lot more competent. But I find it interesting because one thing that is different is the deep state of the Ataturkish Young Turk project, or the, you know, Ataturk and the Young Turks' goal of unifying Turkey and creating a Turkish secular bureaucracy, had a more explicit ethno-ideological goal than you could possibly accuse the bureaucracy of the United States of. Would you agree with that? Because, I mean, I don't know that I find that there is an elite consensus in America, but I don't know that there can be said to be an elite governmental agenda.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not as familiar with the case of the United States, but certainly, you know, like, the political project taking place in Turkey was a very specific one. I think in general sense, you know, that you always have these bureaucratic structures operating political agendas behind the scenes, behind the kind of formal institutions of democracy wherever you are, but the political context matters. You know, Turkey is, compared to the United States, a relatively compact territorial state, whereas the United States is a continental empire, a federal continental empire. So obviously, I think there in America, you have this huge federal bureaucracy at the heart of an imperial state. And, you know, I think often what we're seeing is like factionalism between different factions of that, and they're trying to appropriate power, maintain power to, make themselves seem useful so that they can increase their budget. So I think some of it's material. Obviously, there are individuals within this larger bureaucracy that will have ideological agendas. But yeah, I don't think it's probably in the case of the United States. And again, beyond kind of like during the Cold War era, kind of vague anti-communism, I don't think it has such a clear ideological mission as sort of the Kemalist bureaucracy and the kind of political order of the Turkish military has. So, you know, I think some of it is just bureaucratic inertia. And of course, you know, perhaps we should say, you know, the bureaucracy also, one of its jobs is to, you know, this sounds very crude, is to maintain capitalism, right? In the face of, in the face of social challenges from below. But I would agree, at least on a surface level, I don't think the American bureaucracy has such a clear ideological mission as, for example, the deep state in Turkey did, which was to kind of maintain a capitalist national political order.
Another thing I would actually say, and you and I have talked about this off air, different parts of the United States governmental apparatus operate at different levels of competency. Like the intelligence agencies can be wildly ideological, but mostly competent. Mm-hmm. The military prizes competence, even though it can also be weirdly and hard to understand ideological ways. Like I have pointed out to people that the military's operating ideology right now is not particularly right or left wing. It is something like radical centrism, and it's trying to stand above the political fray in the United States, partly because it is seen as being like as being above that. We can see that in its neutrality, particularly the brass of neutrality, and not allowing itself to be used by the Insurrections Act and during the Trump administration, during the George Floyd protest, which historically speaking had they could have done. The Insurrection Act was invoked, for example, in the LA riots. But they stood above that. You've also seen it where while I don't know why the MSNBC and even some leftists thought this was some great victory for the left, when you have a General Tilly talking about how he was willing to read critical race theory and Mao and Lenin and anything else because it's good to understand theory and to teach it, as some kind of endorsement of that project, is kind of hilarious. But there is a sense in which the military apparatus knows that its legitimacy is because it is seen as being above politics and even maybe above capitalism. That's why it enjoys such popularity in the United States amongst the general public, which it does enjoy. And clearly that's a somewhat fictitious orientation, right? clearly.
I mean, with the U.S. military, and I was discussing this with a friend of mine who's a military veteran, and you know, the kind of conclusion of our discussion was that, you know, the U.S. military has great tactical competence. You know, they know how to do an operation, right? But like strategic thinking and tactical thinking are different things. And another point is, unlike in Turkey, where historically the military was like, we're doing the strategic thinking, and you guys in the government better like listen. In the United States, the relationship between the sort of democratic wings of the state apparatus and the military are a little bit different, right? So, you know, strategic, the military is always having to balance a kind of very short-term political issues with kind of long-term strategic thinking. And I think, obviously, after a time, that takes a toll on the way the military structure works, of who even gets promoted within the military. Again, I'm not an expert on the U.S. military, but, you know, the big, you know, you have to be a kind of team player if you want to get up, if you want to become a high-ranking member of the military. These are political positions, right? So, yes, the U.S. military, I think, sees its, whereas in Turkey, the military saw itself as the guardian of the Republic, right? That they were the true core of the Republic. I think the ideological position of the U.S. military, and this is important, you know, people, Marxists, you know, often downplay the importance of ideology, but the ideological posture of the U.S. military and its relationship to its relationship to political power is different. It sees itself as subordinate to the democratic wings of the U.S. state, and there's a long tradition of that. If tomorrow the military wanted to and could, they could probably execute a coup, right? They, you know, it wouldn't be difficult for them to execute a coup. I think,
and it probably wouldn't even be unpopular. Let's be honest.
It wouldn't even be that unpopular. But you know, ideologically, that the kind of limit on the horizon of imagination, right? You know, like the what they believe is a possible political action is limited by the kind of ideological context in which they are operating, and the kind of inertia of the American state, which at least on paper is very good at maintaining a narrative of continuity despite the major ruptures in American history. Much like Great Britain, there was this like narrative of gradual progressive change, and the military doesn't have the ideological artillery it needs to sort of execute a coup in the country. So the deep state in America, you know, operates, I think, in a slightly different way. It's kind of behind the scenes. And of course, we have to talk about the other like non-state actors, elements outside of the state as well, because one of the concepts of the deep state in Turkey is that they're also connected to all these groups outside of the state. And when we look at the United States, we have all these private firms, military contractors, the rotation of personnel between very, you know, the between the democratic wings of the state, between the bureaucracy, and of course between the private sector. You know, the American state in some ways has very little autonomy, right, from the capitalist class. You know, when we compare China to the United States, I think the big difference is that the Chinese state, through the Communist Party and the organization of the Communist Party, has some autonomy from the capitalist class. They can drag Jack Ma out and, you know, shoot him behind the chemical sheds, right?
Right, but they couldn't do it to other capitalists, and this is something that, like, I don't think is dealt with enough, because they are also dependent on their place in the production chain, and the government knows that, and China knows that it couldn't assume all that overnight, nor does it want to. And Xi Jinping has actually explicitly said that not only were they not going to seize the means of production in all cases, or turn de jure state-run firms into de facto ones, that in fact the role of the markets were probably not going away, or even lessening in the immediate to midterm future. Mm-hmm. And so I point that out because I think the people think because a U.S. state has very little autonomy from capital, which is interesting right now as far as like left theories go, right? Because a whole lot of left theories are positing that there are these interim classes that have total autonomy from capitalists and workers, mm-hmm. which is kind of hilarious to me. But beyond that, that makes China look like it has more autonomy yeah. from capital than it probably actually does, because we have so little. I mean, you know, and that's, you know, I think that doesn't say anything positive or negative about China. Mm-hmm. You know, I would also occasionally like for white collar criminals, even by bourgeois law, to spend their lives in jail. And I don't see it happening a whole lot, but, it is what it is, right? Whereas in China they would, but
yeah. I mean, I think the impunity of the American elite, and the fact that we can now overtly see the impunity of the American elite, is like a fertile breeding ground for conspiracy theories, right?
Bingo.
Even when the kind of explanation is quite mundane, which is like they hired a really good lawyer who knew how to work the system to get them out on a technicality, right? It's very easy to sensationalize. And then of course you know, I think this comes down to a critical point that we have to like emphasize. It's like the difference between thinking systematically and thinking conspiratorially, right? You could say, like these guys get off because they have like their buddy is the judge, right? Mm. And that may be the case sometimes, right? But the real reason is that you have a system that favors, you have a systematic problem, which is that you have a judicial system that favors those who have money. If you're poor, you're absolutely screwed. You get put in jail. You can't go out on bail. You lose your job. You enter into a spiral of all this, that, and the other. It's a brutal society. But if you're rich... And you know, it's like with the cancel culture. You know, people talk about cancel culture all the time. All these celebrities talking about cancel culture don't actually get canceled unless they do something really, really absolutely bonkers. Even Chris Hansen, right? Even Chris Hansen, you know, the Catch a Predator guy who was disgraced, who's been, you know, even that guy is still making money as a YouTube star. Like he hasn't, for all his misconduct, he hasn't seemed to have faced very much except briefly getting arrested for having a check bounce. So this kind of impunity very much beefs up this perception of a conspiracy, because, you know, there's an element of truth to it. It's like the same with the Jewish conspiracies, right? It's like you can pretend that like the reason the United States is pursues a pro-Israeli policy is because they're in, you know, under Zionist occupation, you know, like
the APAC secretly rules everything. Rules, right?
Or you could just say like there's a whole load of like institutional reasons why the United States is like really into supporting Israel, which, yes, Israeli lobbying and support from certain elements of the American Jewish community are a factor, but they aren't, you know, there's nothing conspiratorial or magic about it. It's politics, right?
Right. It's also a way for U.S. to launch military bases into the Middle East, like,
I mean, Joe
and
Biden
prime real
said
estate for that. Like,
it. Joe Biden literally said it, right? He said if they didn't have an Israel, they would have to create one, right? But
and
then
they
you could
can't always
obviously,
rely on Turkey for that, which is what they would like to do.
it's you can always weave a You can always weave an exciting narrative about conspiracies when you know when it's because it's like it's more interesting, it's more exciting, and it's you know it's more sensational, and people are attracted to that kind of stuff. But a kind of boring discussion on like the routineness of the institutions, the banality of the institutions that force this kind of stuff along. Is less sensational. It's like how people view totalitarianism. You know, people in the West view totalitarianism like the John Hurt 1984 movie. You know, it's like really glum and serious. When the reality is a lot more like Death of Stalin, where it's kind of like absurd and ridiculous, right? So the conspiracy adds a certain is to a certain degree a mystification of what is ultimately a systematic person, because it becomes fetishized around certain individuals, and like George Soros, right? You know, like political right. George Soros is the font of all evil, funding this, that, and the other. When you know, when George Soros funds a lot of things, but there's nothing conspiratorial about it. He's a rich billionaire, and billionaires fund political organizations because we live in a political system where capital rules. You know, that's literally the point of capitalism. Feudalism, those who master the land are in control. Capitalism, those who have capital are the masters. And so, is it surprising that a guy with a lot of capital is involved in politics? It would be weird if he wasn't.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to me when you compare this, the liberal left, to the right on this, because the right's more vulgar, but the liberal left can take similar postures. One example is the fact that, like, there are Koch-funded things in, let's say, the Tea Party and the Obama administration. Now, people would tell me the Tea Party was astroturfed. And at a certain point, I think they were right. But when people think it began as an astroturf organization, I don't see a lot of evidence for that, as even its original founders denounced it as being astroturf, indicating that they at least felt that there was a time where it was not. And that is a kind of more subtle form of conspiracy theory. And frankly, it's true enough, all right? But there's also a sense in which it makes you very lazy. And it makes you unaware of where some political opposition may be. And I think frankly, that's why stuff like QAnon threw a lot of people for a loop, is they literally thought all this stuff was had no grassroots content. Then you see something truly insane in the grassroots. We'll tie it back to international conspiracies in a second, but I also wanted to bring up, though, that the ideology of populism, because it tends to have very simple notions of cultural, ideological, and economic quid pro quo, tends to degenerate into this. I mean, Christopher Lash wrote about this in the late 19th century, that the death of the populist movement in America was that as it stalled out and began to be recuperated by the Democrats in the 1920s, it fell into rapid conspiracy thinking. It became also more and more right-wing. More and more anti-Semitic, more and more anti-foreign, started sounding a lot more like the know-nothings. It didn't start out that way at all. It was an agrarian populist left movement. Now, I bring that up because I think this conspiracy thinking, and particularly in regards to foreign politics, can can seem like it's left wing in orientation, but actually be a sign that we are degenerating into something more reactive, and that we really aren't, that we really are headed on a similar trajectory to Tucker Carlson, to be frank. And I say that partly because I've seen it a lot in my life. I've seen a lot of structural thinking degrade into conspiracy thinking, and then a lot of people never quite getting the structural component. And frankly, if you're on the losing side of things, which is why the right, why the cultural right has been given to conspiracies for so long, conspiracies have solved you of failure. They mm-hmm. just they do. And the fact that there are real conspiracies going on, and on a small scale, usually all the time, that you can find enough proof in the world to justify the wildest things. But let's talk about the American apparatus and the deep state. Why we don't think it's competent enough to pull a lot of these broader conspiracies off. I mean, even Gladio, my friend P.A. Chickens was trying to join us tonight, but unfortunately had technical problems, was going to talk about how it's almost impossible to study like the days of lead in Italy now. Are what actually happened with Operation Gladio, because so many conspiracy theorists in Europe and America, both right and left wing, have speculated upon it to the point that you have to filter so much out to figure out what could possibly be real, because so much of a speculation presented as truth without any evidence, because there were real things that happened and that were made available to the public. That it's actually made it more difficult to talk about any of the things that the U.S. government actually did in Italy. It's probably less so in the case that you mentioned in Turkey, only because Turkey has not played the same role in a lot of the U.S. popular political imagination that the days of lead have indirectly. Eurocentrism in this case, for real, for once. You've studied a lot about Kurdistan for obvious reasons. It's kind of literally your specialty academically. It's also part of your background. And we talked off air about how CIA and military intelligence involvement in Kurdistan makes it very hard to believe in omnicompetence on the international stage in regards to them being able to put all these factors and people into place in the way they want. Would you like to talk about that a little bit in specifics?
Yeah, sure. So I just finished this CIA War in Kurdistan book, which is, it's basically the memoirs of the former station chief in Kurdistan in the lead up to the Iraq War. And, you know, that along with, you know, other things I've read in the past really kind of hits home. I mean, and of course, if this guy is, and I take what this fellow has written with a grain of salt, of course, but you know, what comes out of it is the factionalism, the at times incompetence, his frustrations with the bureaucracy in Washington D.C. The fact that, you know, they didn't read his intelligence reports, you know, so obviously some of this book is probably ass covering, right, for the absolute disaster that the Iraq War was, you know, not just from the sort of left perspective as it was a kind of disastrous imperialist war, but from even from the own the targets that the neoconservatives had set themselves for this for the Iraq War. It was a complete disaster and a complete failure. So, you know, this book is a very salty attack on Donald Rumsfeld, on American intelligence, on how little the people executing and creating policy in Washington, D.C. actually understand about what they're doing. Now, of course, they have an effect. You know, they're dumping guns, weapons, patronage into the region. But, you know, there are also people, they are also people who don't know what they're doing. That this guy makes the point, and I agree with his point, you know, the Americans wanted to believe a certain story about how the Iraq War would go and how the inverted commas liberation would go. They bought a lot of snake oil from individuals like Ahmed Chalabi, who were basically fraudsters, but who told the neocons what they wanted to hear about Iraq. And they implemented a bunch of policies, such as dissolving the entire Iraqi state after taking it over, which exacerbated an already extremely dangerous situation. And the reasons they did this was not for any malicious reasons, but due to not because they wished to shatter the Iraqi people or stuff like that. From the American perspective, the optimal outcome would have been a kind of removal of Saddam for power, the maintenance of order in Iraq, and then the kind of privatization and kind of neoliberalization of the Iraqi economy. And then they would have had McDonald's, they would have had like tourist things, you would have had the impoverishment of Iraqi workers and peasants, but there would be enough of a security apparatus so that, you know, people could fly to Baghdad and go, oh, you know, Iraq is so nice nowadays. Look, they have Starbucks, they have, that's basically what happened in Kurdistan. It just didn't happen in the rest of Iraq. And the reason it only happened in Kurdistan is because all the political structures that existed before the war were maintained after the war because the Kurds signed on to the military operation. So, you know, it really highlights that, you know, American policy is often a blundering policy, and that it is not always clear what their objectives are. There are political factions in DC that have their objectives. There are military, there's military, there's intelligence. They have different visions of how things would be executed. One of the striking things of the book, which I was not aware of, was the complete disconnect between the US military and CIA, the bureaucratic hamstring of the CIA by the Donald Rumsfeld, who would not allow military personnel to have like full operational integration into the, and the fact that they didn't understand what was going on the ground, right? That they weren't clear, even, you know, even when they got intelligence, it got lost. And that should bring to attention that there are obviously parts of the world where American intelligence is more competent and more engaged, but many parts of the world they're not, right? Many parts of the world they do not. And so who do they rely on, right? They rely on their local interlocutors, right? So, you know, when it comes to the Syrian civil war, you know, I think the conspiracy story that we hear is that America funded Al-Qaeda to overthrow Assad. And often I feel the implication of that is that this was some kind of deliberate policy, was to, you know, fund Al-Qaeda. I don't think Americans, or at least American policymakers, were like, oh, we're going to fund Al-Qaeda, right? They were funding people who were sold to them, just as Ahmed Chalabi, who had like no support in Iraq, like managed to kind of set himself up as the kind of potential future leader of a post-Saddam Iraq. The guy was an utter fraud. I mean, his whole family was a fraud. His nephew basically I used to know his nephew. His nephew was just like they got robbed. They tried to rob a bunch of drugs of people in London, and they got robbed in the end. But, you know, we're just like these kind of like shady, dirty gangster people who are like always looking for their next thing. And of course, this means that America has a lot of guns, money, and influence. And if you know what to say, if you're like, if you dress in America, like in a business suit and say the right words, you can dupe a lot of people into giving you support. And even if the intelligence guys don't buy you, you go to someone else. And this is again, this book on the war in CIA said like CIA issued a burn notice on Ahmed Chalabi. I'm like, this guy's total basket case. He just went to the Department of Defense and got them to sign on to his nonsense, right? And so you have this bureaucratic infighting. So, you know, in Syria, you had the CIA working with Turkey. As far as I understand, Turkey was its own factor. They were setting up their guys, and that ended up with stuff going to like very radical Islamist groups. Department of Defense ended up working out of necessity, and ended up working with the PYD, the kind of PKK franchise in Syria, largely out of like necessity, because they didn't want like a huge, you know, after the fall of Mosul, they didn't want ISIS to be getting any more major victories, and those were the only guys on the ground. So, you know, I say all this to say that it's very hard when you get into the nuts and bolts of this to think that there's like an extremely coherent policy being executed on the ground. You know, in the Middle East, of course, there's a perception that the United States is trying to divide these countries. They want to create a new Israel. There's blah, blah, this, blah, blah, that, all these huge conspiracies. From the American perspective, they want, you know, governments to be stable and to be pro-American, right? You know, if you split up a country like Syria or Iraq, you end up with, yes, you end up with one guy who's like your permanent ally, but then suddenly you have the other half of the former unified country as your permanent enemy. It's best to keep them all integrated and have some kind of arrangement in it. And of course, this conspiratorial thinking absolutely eviscerates any notion that people in places like the Middle East or Latin America have any agency in what they do, that they're entirely puppets being pulled by you know, imperial powers. It's like, for example, the coup in Bolivia, and I'm sure we'll find out more about this as documents are declassified. But you know, only a gringo could be so arrogant that they couldn't believe that reactionary forces in a deeply racist country like Bolivia couldn't try and orchestrate a coup, right?
You know, particularly against a party with mass indigenous support and an indigenous leader. Yeah, I mean, and
They don't need the
also,
CIA to tell them to do that.
right. I mean, this is one thing that I think people don't understand is that maybe the CIA might be on the ground with all sides, like they were. If people actually study where the CIA was in Cuba, they were helping Castro sometimes, and other times trying to kill him. Like it, they were all over the place. They have usually have a strategy of investment in all sides and in chicanery in all sides. But I think the Al-Qaeda example is very interesting because, you know, there's all this like Al-Qaeda was a U.S. creation, but then you have to believe that Al-Qaeda was created to attack the U.S. to justify, I guess, the Patriot Act. Because if you go far enough back with that, you see that U.S. Saudi and Afghani policy in the 80s is key to how all this began. And that doesn't seem like a story of competence. It seems like a story of mutual hubris between the Americans and the Soviet Union. You know, like, and no side really understanding the people in place they were messing with and destabilizing all kinds of forces in so doing, both in the case of the USSR and in the case of the United States supporting the Mujahideen. I find that interesting, but I don't particularly find it compelling to believe that the Al-Qaeda was a U.S. State Department or, you know, CIA project. It just there doesn't seem to be enough evidence for that. I have known people in the military who believed it wasn't really one consistent thing, and that our perception of it as a unified whole was a Bush administration conjuring. But that's not the same thing. Like, and also it doesn't require as many people to be involved. Like, some sketchy messaging versus inventing a Islamist political force is those are very different levels of scale.
Yeah. Well, it comes down to the difference between strategic and tactical thinking. You know, from a tactical perspective, arming group, you know, radical Islamists in the you know, in Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union to teach them a lesson for what they did in Vietnam makes a lot of sense. But of course, I don't think they were like, oh, we're going to use Al Qaeda in the few, you know, 20 years down the line to attack, you know, to justify a war on terrorism. If anything, the whole Al Qaeda thing was a distraction from what they really wanted to do, which was to invade Iraq, right? You know, like the objective was Iraq for these guys, right? Who the Bush administration people. Had there been no 9/11, it would have perhaps would have been easier for them to fabricate. They could have still fabricated a casus belli on Iraq and fought the war that they wanted to all along. right? So, you know, I don't think, yeah, I think some of this conspiratorial thinking doesn't help. And even when organizations are like funded with the support of certain nation states, it doesn't mean that those organizations are under the control of those nation states. Look at an organization like the PLO, which was established, you know, under the purview of the Egyptian state, but you know, obviously, over time, you know, became like its own independent entity, acting according to its interests. I think we need to look at the relationship between entities and political movements and things around the world and imperial power in far more of a dialectical way to see how they interact with each other. You know, and at times, even when there is a major differentiation in power, you know, objectively weaker groups are able to manipulate and shift the political agenda of an imperial power in a way that is, you know, beneficial to that group. That's not to ju and none of this is to justify sort of imperial adventurism, but I think it's critically important that we gain a realistic understanding of how imperial power works, not in a conspiratorial way, but in a kind of like systematic way, where America, as the kind of core of the imperial world, exercises power in a you know, exercises a enormous economic and military power around the world. But there is no kind of octopus head at the center of all these tentacles controlling everything. Rather, you have you know, a brain with some kind of like multiple personality syndrome and, you know, periodic amnesia operating all these extremely powerful arms around the world.
And on that note, we're going to have to end tonight, and we're going into the parrot room. I will see you in a few minutes.